Hello and welcome to Double Stint, Sports Car 365 sports car racing podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Grace, and I'm joined today by our European editor, Davey Ovema. Davey, a little bit of racing action and plenty of news coming out. How was your week?
Pretty good. Well, there was some racing over the weekend, which we'll get into shortly, which was the 12 Hours of Mugello Kurventic, which was, as usual, a pretty spectacular and, in this case, very wet affair. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to getting into all that. And still a fair bit of news, including a brand new Peugeot to get into. So, yeah, lots to cover.
Well, we've got a packed show for you today. We'll recap some of the racing action from the weekend, take a look at some of the week's biggest news headlines, the Peugeot news included, and answer some listener questions. All that and more on this week's episode of Double Stint. Well, Davey, there was set to be a couple of bits of racing action this weekend. We'll start with NES, which was canceled. And you've been following along with this story really since the beginning of the divide with NES and NLS or BLN. We originally had track running planned for NES to take place on Saturday for some season opening competition, but we don't have an official reason for the cancellation, but we know there are growing tensions here between the two organizing bodies. And this seems to have potentially contributed to the canceling of the event, although we did still get some track running.
Yes, indeed. I have been sort of tracking this for a while now because it just seems to keep on rolling. Like I said, there were supposed to be two 90-minute races for the Nürburgring Endurance Series NES on the Grand Prix circuit, actually, not on the Nordschleife, but these were cancelled. Like I said, an official reason wasn't given, although it should be noted that through this wonderful new system called OnGrid, which I've sort of starting to familiarise myself with, where basically all of these relevant documents are sort of public in one place. So you've got timetables, entry lists, except for NES, there was never an entry list. By the time of the cancellation, the word on the street is that there were not enough entries, although that's not been confirmed. But yeah, that was then changed to testing, which, interestingly enough, did include the Nordschleife. And there seems to be something going on behind the scenes there, because this is a statement that was released by NES, which the reason it gave for the sort of the weird thing where your race wasn't on the Nordschleife but your testing is on the Nordschleife is quite, this is because volunteer helper groups, stewards, section leaders, officials, external service providers and other stakeholders and even teams and drivers who remain neutral in the performance of their professional duties or predominantly voluntarily leisure activities are facing increasingly massive pressure from people claiming to be acting on behalf of and in the name of VLN/NLS and the ADAC. Now, and that is, I think, immediately an indicator of where this whole thing is sort of escalating to, between on the one hand you've got the AVD and NES, and on the other hand you have VLN and NLS, which is then backed by ADAC. There's some real power struggles going on here, and which has resulted in these two split championships, which is a result of a court ruling earlier this year. It's a long-running dispute, basically, between the circuit owners and VLN, which, again, then is backed by ADAC. So it's a whole mess of alliances and conflicting interests, and it's all a bit of a mess. And there have been people who said that ultimately the ones that are, you know, going to suffer from this is the fans, the drivers, the teams, and everybody that just wants to race at the Nordschleife and now has to navigate its way through this whole split set up with different championships and races and calendars and everything.
Yeah, that was one of our initial concerns here, was that it was going to impact the actual racing, and it seems, it has already impacted the initial running, you know, before the first run of the season even got going. So we hope that this starts to get smoothed out and some agreements are reached, and whatever consolidation needs to happen can happen, or whatever the resolution to this looks like. I'm not sure, but we do hope at the end of the day that we get all of the track running that we and the rest of the fans and the drivers and teams were all promised and all looking forward to.
Yeah, I suppose for a bit of added clarity, now that this has fallen away, the first scheduled race for NES, because it seems to be a bit confusing as well, because the weird thing is NLS, if you translate that from German, it means Nürburgring Endurance Championship, but that's obviously not the same series now. So we've got NES, which is the Nürburgring Endurance Series, and then NLS, which is the old championship, the pre-existing championship. But basically my whole point with this whole tangent is that the next race for NES is scheduled to take place on the 3rd and 4th of May.
Well, we're certainly hoping that that goes on without a hitch. Well, you mentioned it earlier, but we also had some track running at Mugello for the 24-hour series, where GP Elite survived some late race rain and came out on top to lead a Porsche 1-2.
Indeed, they did. It's the first overall victory for this Dutch squad, which I'm not going to lie was obviously something that I was quite pleased with, given that I know these guys quite well from sort of around the block at Zandvoort. You see them quite a lot. They're very, very experienced Porsche squad. Have been running one-make Porsche racing for many, many years in Carrera Cup Benelux, Carrera Cup Germany, the Porsche Mobile 1 Super Cup. And now they are making this journey into GT3 racing with an all-silver driver crew, or semi-pros, as Kreventic would say, under their ranking system. It was a lead that they had from the first 6.5 hours on Saturday. As we all know, Kreventic has this system where it's not 12 hours continuously like we would have with the Sebring 12 hours, which we had recently. No, it's 6.5 hours, throw the flag, break overnight, reconvene in the morning, and basically the order, the running order that you had when the first 6.5 hours were completed, you have that for the rest of the race. So they held a lead coming out of the overnight intervention, and they basically just extended that. Like I said, some rain that came roughly, I'd say, 20 minutes into the final hour, the second to last hour, I should say. And that sort of got worse and worse. And it was some pretty, if you were looking at the feed, it was some pretty serious rain at one point. And that ultimately came to a head when another Porsche from the Spanish E2P racing team hit some standing water on the main straight, swerved, got on the grass, lost complete control, spun back across the track and hit the wall on the inside, which basically completely destroyed the front of that Porsche. And that was basically it for the race, because at that point, race control went, okay, that was with about 32 minutes left. So with this much rain and now a car destroyed on the tracks, you know, obviously scattering debris everywhere, there's no point in getting back to green. So the final sort of half an hour of the 12 hours run under code 60, which is essentially kind of a full course yellow where you have to run at 60 kph, but ultimately didn't really influence the result. But I think the GP League guys had a 2-lap lead at that point, I believe, so that was never going to be in jeopardy. And in that way, it's a very good win for this team. I think their first big win in GT3 racing. They came close with the 12 hours of Kuwait the year before last, where they had a very rare gearbox failure very late in the race. So hopefully they'll be able to build on it from here. I've spoken to a few times as a team with pretty big ambitions to go international. So hopefully they'll be able to make that happen.
Well, certainly looking forward to seeing what GP Elite can do from here on out after their first, as you said, major overall win. Well, Davey, let's dive into some of the news of the week, and we've got some big headlines here, and our first large headline deals with a huge update here for the 9X8, the Peugeot LMH car. It's got a rear wing and plenty of other changes beyond the initial obvious one. They initially went with a square setup, 31 centimeters for their four tires. They've changed that now to a staggered 29 centimeter front, 34 centimeter rear setup. And according to Peugeot, 90 to 95% of the body surfaces have been changed and re-sculpted as well, which is impressive considering that when you look at the car, it looks like it's kept a lot of the original design language. It is still very much the Peugeot 9X8 that we visually can identify, obviously, with the new rear wing. But they've done a lot of work to update this car.
Yep. It was revealed this morning. It was Sports Car Racing's worst kept secret, I suppose, that this car was going to get a rear wing. They even, I think, acknowledged it themselves when it was leaked, when the car was part testing with this setup at Paul Ricard a few months ago. New livery as well. Which is still sort of that they've kept that. There was always this neon green that was always in there, and they've kept that now, but now it looks a bit more camo-esque. I quite dig it, to be honest. It looks quite cool. Very, very different direction for Peugeot, one that they'd embarked on for quite a while now. Obviously, we saw the wingless wonder, the previous 9X8, the last time out at Qatar, where it did very well until it didn't do very well in the final minutes of that race. And the weird thing is, when that happened, people were like, oh, you know, the car's good, why won't they keep it? Well, that was obviously because they had a very favorable BOP. BOP is a topic here that we'll get to in a moment. And it was a track that suited the original specification, and 9X8 probably as best as it ever was going to. So, and they were never going to switch plans anyway. So this was always in the works for Imola. Late next month is when we will see this new 9X8. In action for the first time. And like I said, that it's very easy to think that they've just whacked a rear wing on the thing, because it looks so similar. That's the interesting thing, where they, like I said, Olivier Janssen, technical director, said 90 to 95% of the surface of the car have been modified. But when you look at the pictures, it looks remarkably similar to the old car. So fair play to them for being able to do that. And that's, I think, why many people think, oh, it's just a car with a wing. But this change in tire concept here, that is extremely important in the wider context of it, because the original car was designed with that 31-31 setup all around, and that just turned out to be a much bigger weakness than they perhaps initially anticipated, which is why they've abandoned that, gone to 29 front, 34 rear, which is sort of the norm across the hypercar class. And obviously, racing car design is never in a vacuum. So you can't just change the tyres and be done with it. There's so many effects that brings along that you have to contend with. And that is ultimately this part of this grander package from Peugeot, which the tyre size I mentioned, the aerodynamic changes, it all sort of fits together into what on paper should be creating a far better package than the original 9X8 ultimately was. The Monaco kind of crash structures are unchanged, as is the hybrid system, but the gearbox and the engine have received some reliability-focused updates. And the interesting thing, this is something I alluded to earlier, is that Janssen seemed to indicate that the sort of idea of it all is to make the car less dependent on balance of performance. So something that basically overall makes the car good, strong, no matter what the BOP was going to be like. Because again, in Qatar, the car was very strong, was very quick in qualifying, very good in the race, should have gotten a podium, but that was because it was running at the minimum permissible weight and the maximum power at Qatar, so it was ever as good as it was ever going to get. So that maybe clouded it a little bit, whereas now they want a car that is going to be competitive no matter what the ACO and the FIA give them to run.
While we don't know how many Evo Jokers Peugeot used, we know that they have put a ton of work into this car. They've been developing and testing it for a long time, and I think Imola is going to be a very big test to see how far they've come. Obviously, when you're introducing any big updates, there is a little bit of an asterisk on it with some tempered expectations, but it seems like Peugeot was very excited about some of these positive changes, reliability and performance-wise, and I know we're all very excited to see what the 9X8 can do. Well, our other big bit of news here revolves around a four-time F1 world champion in Sebastian Vettel, who is set to test a Porsche 963 with Porsche Penske Motorsport at Motorland Aragon. And this is a big one, Davey. It's a big test as well. It's a 36-hour endurance test in preparation for the 24 Hours of Le Mans. He'll be joining Matt Campbell, Michael Christensen, Fred McElwecky, Kevin Estre, Andre Lauterer, and Lawrence Vantor. And Vettel's already done a lot of prep work here. He's completed a shakedown in Vysok. He's done some prep work at Porsche Penske Motorsports headquarters in Mannheim. He's done some simulator work as well. He seems pretty serious about this. And there's no news until there's news, but this looks to me from the outside to be a little bit more than just a joyride.
That is, we had this very same discussion in the virtual Sports Car 365 office, didn't we? Where on the one hand, you could go, okay, he's a complete rookie to anything with a closed roof, anything significant apart from, I think, some Race of Champions stuff here and there. And he's you know, never done sports cars, he's never done Le Mans, so why would you put the guy in for your biggest race of the year with no notable racing experience? On the other hand, why would you make so much noise about a test if you didn't have any more significant intentions with it? In any case, it's super cool. I think Vettel was already sort of, there were some rumors circling around last year linking him to Jota, which ultimately that didn't happen. And then they went with some other Formula One world champion. So it's going to be very interesting. Like you said, it's already, the preparation is clearly very serious. Going to the headquarters, shaking the car down at Vysok, this is not just no arrive and drive. I want to have a go and try this car type of thing. It's also very telling that they're including him in arguably their most important test of the entire year, which is this 36-hour Le Mans pre-prep endurance test at Aragon, with all of these other factory drives that he'll be able to, you know, bounce off of and learn from. There's no doubt that Vettel is still an exceptionally talented racing driver. I think his last years in Formula One maybe made people a little bit doubt him, but you know, he's still a full-time world champion. He can still, I'm sure, operate at an exceptionally high level. Whatever comes of this, it would be really cool to see Vettel in a 963 at Le Mans. It should also be noted, of course, that Porsche hasn't actually announced the other two drivers for that third car yet. Mathieu Jaminet, the only confirmed name at this point. So there are still some seats open, at least publicly. So yeah, wait and see. But I'm sure there's going to be some very cool images of Vettel actually sending that 963 around Aragon not too soon from now.
Yeah, I think I can speak for all of us when I say, yeah, this would just be a cool one, wouldn't it, to see Vettel at Le Mans?
Yeah.
I think there wouldn't be anybody who wouldn't be anything other than incredibly excited to see the four-time world champ take on the 24 hours. Well, let's head into some news revolving around BMW, who is proceeding, quote, according to plan with their M4 GT3 Evo, which is planned for debut next year. They're actually planning to have the cars rolled out and on track to test by the end of the year. But David, you had a nice chat with BMW Motorsport Director Andreas Roos, who gave you some insight into how this whole project is going, and it looks like everything's going according to schedule.
Yeah, so this has been going on for a while, because you may remember, actually, we discovered this. We broke the news that BMW was working on this car when I was at a spa test and found an M4 with camouflage on it. Went, that's interesting. and then basically talked to Roos and said, yep, this is our Evo, which kind of, for me, came as a bit of a surprise. But the way he explained it back then, and it's just it's the position that they've held and the way that they've worked through, is actually a very, very well planned out sequence, where, as you may remember, the car debuted in 2022, so that gives it an initial three-year cycle. Obviously, this is the final year of that cycle, which is crazy because it's March. We've had three big races, but basically what they were doing is all of 2023 was development, and obviously the car wasn't publicly seen until that spa test in September. And so basically when you're done with the development at 2023, at the end of it, then you have all of 2024 to do the final bits, start producing it, homologating it, which is a key part, so you can have the car ready and rolled out for your customers at the end of this year. The homologation hasn't happened yet, my understanding is. They wanted to, but they couldn't find a date with the FIA, so that will be in the second half of this year. But other than that, it all seems to be running, according to rules, perfectly according to plan, which, I mean, if you're planning it out this long, then, yeah, I'm pretty sure that, yeah, you will have some time to all do it properly. But it's very clear that, you know, they're not leaving anything to chance here. There's no stone unturned, which is also a bit scary, because the M4 GT3 is already a very, very competitive car. So if they're taking it this seriously this early with the Evo, some of the competitors might have to be a bit careful.
You mentioned the positive performance from the M4 GT3 already, and considering that some of the changes, like you spoke to, are revolved around drivability and larger performance windows at more tracks, aiming to make it more competitive, and they say they're not chasing lap times specifically with this Evo kit. Yeah, that should have everybody kind of shaking in their boots a little bit.
Yeah, and actually the motivation and the thought behind that is actually very clear, because Roos outlined this, and it's basically, we are not seeking performance gains. For the simple reason is, we're in a BOP formula. There's no point, because you can make the car a second a lap quicker. But if IMSA or WEC or SRO then comes out and slashes that, then you've wasted resources, money, time, effort. So instead of chasing performance, you know, you chase other things, like you said, like drivability. So yeah, that's sort of the way they've gone about this. We haven't got a reveal date for the car yet. Of course, once we know that, and once we have anything on this car, we will be sure to let you know. So keep tuned to sportscar365.com for the latest on the M4 GT3 Evo.
Well, Isada Fascini has their eyes on a future customer car program for its Tipo 6 Competizione, which has debuted this year at the WEC opening round in Qatar, will contest this WEC season. They were only granted one spot on the WEC grid this year, despite initially planning to run two cars. And this is kind of a tricky one. With everybody interested, and by everybody, I mean everyone from major manufacturers to boutique manufacturers, planning to run cars in the top class, you know, we've talked about this at length before, how much is too much. It seems like the WEC has kind of unofficially capped the entries going forward at around 22 hypercars, and obviously they have figures for the overall grid as well. And how this plays into it, we have yet to see. Obviously, nothing happening at the moment. There's no news on a customer program, but it is something they have their eyes on, and it's something they would be open to say the least.
Yeah, this is what Claudio Barro, who's the motorsport manager for Isada Fascini, told us at the World Endurance Championship opener in Qatar, where it says, quote, "Our project is a long-term project, and that includes customer teams." He says that there are a lot of people interested in the car. Obviously, we don't know who that would be. Imagine, you know, any LMP2 teams would be, well, not any of them, but some of them would, I suppose, be prospective customers as a way to get themselves onto the hypercar grid. But like you said, this is there's a very big asterisk to all of this, and this and that is, of course, can they get the space? Because any effort would be subject, of course, to being granted a grid slot by the WEC amidst a potential expansion to the overall size of 40 cars, 22 of which would be hypercar entries. And of course, you've got to consider that there are other players as well. Of course, Aston Martin has expressed the goal to be on the World Endurance Championship grid next year. And how many more customer cars from Porsche and Ferrari are coming, for example. So it is wait and see. It's always nice. I think I like the idea of customer cars. You know, Porsche's done it very well, I think, and they've been the benchmark, or the only ones, more or less, and the benchmark on this. But to me, it sort of always brings back images of Group C days, where you had, again, Porsche's with the factory team battling with, you know, with Brunn and with Joost and all them teams. So, yeah, this is a wait and see one. It's interesting that they're considering it, and we're going to have to wait how it develops, because we also, of course, need to consider that this is a car that's in its very, very early stages of its life cycle. So a lot more development from the manufacturer of the car coming, I'm sure, as well. And I'm sure they want to tackle some of the issues that it's been having before you actually sell it to your customers. Otherwise, things could get ugly rather quickly.
That's a very fair point. It's an ambitious plan at that, but one to certainly keep an eye on, and we'll keep you updated as there's any developments where Isada Fascini and their potential customer car program is concerned. Well, LMP2 has received a power boost amongst other changes in the European Le Mans series. They get 40 horsepower now, now up to 580 horsepower, a larger fuel tank now at 75 liters of capacity, and they're 20 kilograms lighter as well. They're expected to be about 1 second faster in terms of overall lap time here for the European Le Mans series. It's important to note that these changes are not coming to the LMP2 cars competing at the 24 Hours of Le Mans, and the reason for these changes in the ELMS are that they no longer have to be balanced and stratified against a top class, as they are the top class in ELMS. I think everybody on the grid that's going to be piloting one of these LMP2 cars is going to be very, very happy to see a car that's faster, lighter, and can take more fuel on.
Yeah, but to clarify that stratification thing, obviously you don't have to stratify anything in the European Le Mans series because they're top class, but that performance was pulled level with the FIA World Endurance Championship. Because there they did have to be, of course, stratified to match sort of or prepare them for the arrival of the hypercars a few years ago. So they were sort of steadily pulled back in performance, and to basically make sure that it was all one straight line across the board, the level of performance that the cars had in the WEC was the same level that they had in European Le Mans Series. Obviously, the change now is that LMP2 is no longer a part of the World Endurance Championship, so there's no reason to keep these cars sort of pegged back in the ELMS, because there's nothing to match them against anymore. And that's the reason why we are having this power increase now. And I've already heard some noises from a few teams, because this was always understood to be coming. It's now just the official confirmation of this power increase, but this was always sort of something that we knew was going to happen. We've spoken to some teams and some drivers that are involved in LMP3 and LMS, and they're all very happy because obviously the car had been slowed down quite a bit over the last couple of years, which was never the most fun. And these are still some very, very fast cars, because the crazy thing is, if you look at the lap times that these LMP2s are pulling, they are about as fast as sort of LMP1 cars were about 10 to 15 years ago. So I think these cars are quicker, as quick or quicker than the sort of the diesel Audis pre-hybrid, for example. So these are very, very quick cars. You just don't really think of them that way because they are the second prototypes. They're very quick, and yeah, people are very excited to have these back on the maximum power level. Now, as you mentioned, there is one caveat to this, and that is once we get to Le Mans, where, of course, they do have to be balanced again against the hypercars, they will go back to the same specification that they ran at Le Mans last year. So that means a slightly higher minimum weight, so 950 kilograms, and an air restrictor of 35 millimeters and a rev limit. So they'll be slightly pegged back again once they do go back up against the hypercars at Le Mans.
Well, let's throw some other quick headlines at you before we move on with the show. And we'll start with Ford, who has unveiled some of the teams and drivers for their inaugural Mustang Challenge season. So far, we know that there's going to be 16 teams piloting the Mustang Dark Horse Rs, 11 of which have already been named, alongside 34 drivers who have been named. Ford has also unveiled a two-class structure here for this new series, the Dark Horse Class and the Dark Horse Legends Class, which is an optional categorization for drivers 45 years and older. The season kicks off at Mid-Ohio, June 5th through 7th. Well, we've got plenty of lineup news in the news headlines this week. IGTC has lineup and entry news from Manti EMA, Sharer Sport PHX, Vulcan Horse, RMG, and Apt as well. GT World Challenge America has lineup news from S's Racing, Wright Motorsports, and Flying Lizard. And in GT World Challenge Europe, we've got Century Motorsport and ASP with lineup and entry news as well. Plenty of headlines for you to pore over on sportscar365.com. As with all the other news headlines, that you can check out more on the website, and we encourage you to check out Sportscar 365 Plus as well for more exclusive and in-depth content coming your way each month. Well, let's dive into answering some listener questions, and Dave, we've got a couple of them here in the comment section of our last Double Stint episode, and we'll start with a question from Ricky Zagata asking, after multiple races with rollover accidents, is it time for Sebring to give safety a rethink? Obviously, if you missed the 12 hours of Sebring this year, Pipo Derani had a massive crash where his car was rolled over. He was okay, and the car and the safety technology behind it, the rather impressive safety technology, I must say, did its job tremendously, and he was unharmed. But we have seen quite dramatic accidents at Sebring. Part of it is the nature of the beast. It's a bumpy and very, very quick track with a lot of high-risk sections. And, you know, I think safety is always at the forefront. The cars continue to get safer, and the natural assumption would be that the circuits should as well. I think in the case of Pipo's crash, everything did its job. The car did its job. The very brief runoff area he went through did a little bit of job of arresting the speed, and the tires did their job of absorbing some of the momentum, albeit in a very dramatic way. But I think this is always a consideration, Davey, of how safe are the circuits, and should they continue to evolve and get safer as well?
Yeah, because as you point out, he wasn't the first. I think we had Jose Maria Lopez, of course, rolled over in a WEC race. Now, I can't remember if that was last year or the year before, but he did definitely roll over. And we also had last year's lap, well, not lap one, but it was a very early rollover for Luis Perez Compank in the WEC race in the GTE Ferrari. Now, of course, the big thing with all of these three crashes is that the drivers walked away. So in that regard, you are right, the safety systems that are in place did do their jobs. Now, should it get a safety rethink? I think that is a very, very difficult question to answer. Ultimately, I think that there's always room for the sport to get safer. I think Pipo's accident looked very scary, but ultimately, I think, like I said, everything did its job and he was able to walk away. The nature of the beast is, like I said, is a very fast circuit. I'm sure there's always ways to make the sport safe, but also I think many people are scared that if you do start making changes, that perhaps it could go and I don't want to say ruin, but affect the nature and the character of Sebring, which of course is a very beloved and old school circuit. I think the debate, should it get repaved, pops up about once a year, usually around the 12 hour. I'm sure there's always ways we can figure out to make it safer, and if there is room for that, then I'm all for it, because ultimately we want to see these drivers, you know, be safe and healthy and make it through a race without serious injury or worse. So maybe we should have a look at where we can make some alterations here and there. But I think it's also very important that if we do that, don't sort of try and keep Sebring, because Sebring is what makes Sebring, if that makes sense.
It's a fair point. And, you know, this is a conversation that comes up with a lot of the old character-rich tracks, Sebring, the Nürburgring, the Nordschleife specifically, and Spa. You know, you think how many times a year do we hear about Rouge and Radeon getting a rethink? And it is that careful balancing act between how do you maintain the original characteristic of a track that we all know and love and the drivers enjoy driving, but one that's inherently risky. Is it something that's just part of the sport and that we have to accept, or is it something that we can do our best to always minimize the risk of? I think the answer probably lies somewhere in the middle. In my mind, if the cars are getting safer, the tracks should as well. But again, it's so much easier said than done. You know, I would hate to see for any of these tracks lose the characteristics. I would hate to see Sebring lose the bumps. And part of what makes Sebring so great, aside from the bumps, is the fact that it's pretty unforgiving, and it bites you if you go off and make a mistake. And I think that's part of what makes Sebring so special. So I would hate to see the track lose that characteristic. But at the same time, if there are, you know, barrier technologies or runoff room technologies that can improve the safety and limit either cars flipping over or the intensity of some of these accidents, that I'm absolutely all for.
Agreed.
Well, we have another question here from Pass on the Outside, who asks, Owen Trinkler was not co-driving the number 46 TGM Aston for Sebring, with Paul Holton driving instead. Any notes on why? Still something to do with his burn injuries from Daytona testing. Is Holton in for the remainder of the season? This is one we're going to look more into. We don't have a definitive answer on, and we're still trying to get to the bottom of it for you. You know, we do obviously hope that Owen is okay, and that's the most important part, but put a pin in it. We're looking into it, and we'll get back to you on this one. Our third question here is from Racing Duck, saying Vanderhelm stands out for me, closed a gap of 10 seconds to Campbell and Van de Zander in his last half hour, overtaking Jordan in the meanwhile. JDC and Proton do a great job, but the young kids matching the pace of the pros was unexpected. No mistakes and outpacing his teammates. Yeah, I think Team and Vanderhelm has been very impressive as well. You know, I think the success of the Porsche customer cars in IMSA has been great. Proton looked really, really strong. Obviously, was on for a very good result until the end there. And I think the banana boat JDC was doing a great job as well. But I think it's been really exciting to see what some of these young guns can do. And you're right, matching the pace of the pros is kind of what it's all about here. And I think it's great to see. I'm loving Tiemann's work so far in the car, and looking forward to seeing what he can do in the future here, Davey.
Absolutely. And I think the interesting thing is he's still very young. He's just 20 years old, which is a bit of a surprise considering how long he's been racing, because he's been he started his career in karts in, I think, like 2012 or 2013. So if you do a quick bit of maths, he's been in a car since a very, very young age. Came up through single seaters, won, I think, a race in the Toyota Racing Series. Notable people on that particular grid, people like Oliver Rasmussen, remember him, Liam Lawson, remember him, and Yuki Tsunoda. It was only one race that he won, but still, beating a grid like that, it has to account for something. Then Formula 3, which was not a great season, and then he moved into sports cars, debuted in LMP2, and he's been chipping away at LMP2 for 2 years, and there's definitely been progression there, because in his last season, we're talking 2023, which is still the same year he started doing his first races with that prototype in IMSA, he got three podium finishes and finished third in the LMP2 standings. So this is, I think, somebody who's been under the radar, sort of chipping away at it. And I think another factor is that it's now a car that, you know, he's been racing since Laguna Seca last year. He's got plenty of track time in it now. So perhaps it's also a car that he started to sort of get more comfortable with, starting to get more on top of. And like I said, he's still very young. He's got some very, very good teammates to learn from. I think there's no better coach in racing at this point than Richard Westbrook to be in a situation like that. He had Michael Rockenfeller last year, of course. So this is, I think, is just somebody who's been learning a lot and is now starting to translate that into some credible performances on track. So I'm very interested to see where he goes next with this 963 from JDC Miller Motorsports.
Well, as always, thank you for writing in your questions. We always appreciate them, and we love answering them on the show. And if you've got a burning question you'd like us to answer on Double Stint, be sure to post it in the comment section below this episode, or take to Twitter and post your question there using the hashtag AskDoubleStint, and we'll put our heads together to answer it in an upcoming episode. Well, Davey, while we don't have anything on the docket for next week directly, we've got SRO competition looming just a few weeks away. SRO is headed in America to Sonoma and to Paul Ricard in Fanatec GT World Challenge Europe, powered by AWS, in just a couple weeks' time. So keep it tuned to Sports Car 365 for all the news and developments as we await those opening rounds in just a few weeks' time. Well, that's going to do it for us this week on the podcast. If you've got the time, we'd greatly appreciate a rating and review on your podcatcher of choice. It really helps out the show. Thank you so much for joining us wherever you're tuning in from. For Davey Ovema, I'm Jonathan Grace. We'll see you right back here next week for another edition of Double Stint.